From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today, taking the corn syrup out of the pantry. How to make your own condiments from scratch. Gobs. What they are and how to make them. Jonathan Gold takes us back in time to 1986. What causes salmon to lose their sense of smell? We'll find out the latest trends in restaurant design, plus what do bluefin tuna and cattle have in common. But first, let's see what's fresh and in season this 30th anniversary week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We are celebrating 30 years at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. We've been talking about this for months, and here it is. DJ Olson is here. He's the chef at Lou. We talk to him frequently on the Market Report. And DJ, in honor of the 30th anniversary, is doing a whole series of farmer-themed prefix dinners at Lou with wine pairings. And he features a different farmer and a different product every week. Now, last Monday, DJ, you did something great with Maggie's Farm. And you can share that recipe with us today?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. You know, I realized that I've been shopping here since 1991, 20 years. Oh. And the first person I bought produce from was Maggie's Farm. And so I thought, if I'm going to do, I'm doing five of these dinners. And I thought the first one should be Maggie's Farm. So we did one last Monday. It was great fun because Nate also grows some chickens and eggs. And so we got some of those chickens, and Nate and I got together on the Sunday before. We made chicken, fennel pollen, and garlic sausage. The fennel pollen I harvested up in the Santa Monica Mountains. And we served that with all the produce from his stand, including Cavallo Nero. His mother runs Kenter Farms, and so we took some red peppers from Kenter Farms, some onions, a little bit of tomato. We did herb polenta. I made a panna cotta with lemon verbena, and also some oranges. I made an orange gelée to go over the top of that, and I made a little rosemary butter cookie using rosemary from it. So, but the Cavallo Nero was a really nice thing. I took and put the Cavallo Nero with the peppers and onions, tomatoes, and also the green part of frise, because we started the dinner with a frise radicchio wild arugula salad, was one of their poached eggs on the top, and some of our house-cured bacon. It was great.
That's so great. And the peppers, or is that real sweet? What kind of peppers did you use?
I'm not sure what the variety. They look like the red lipstick peppers, only they're longer. And I just julienned them really thinly, and then I julienned a red onion very thinly, and julienned tomato really thinly, and then tossed them with salt, pepper, olive oil, and then put them in a 500-degree oven. They got kind of slightly charred, and so I kept that to the side. Then I took the Cavallo Nero, stripped all the stems out, and blanched it a little bit, and then I threw all of that pepper, onion, tomato mix in with the Cavallo Nero, and then also the green parts of frise, because I don't like the green parts in the salad. I don't like to eat it raw, but I do. It adds a nice bitter element. And poured in a little olive oil in the pan, a little bit of chicken stock, and just braised it until it all came together. And then we put that on top of, I made a polenta with parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. And we made cakes out of that, which we fried in olive oil. And then we put that on the top. And then we topped it with the chicken sausage that we had made. So it was a really colorful plate and just so herby, and then perfect example of what Maggie's does so well.
Oh, that's so great. And what you do so well, your recipes, they're just layer after layer after layer. I mean, I'm good with just the roasted vegetables in the oven, and then you add all this other stuff. So it's just so great. DJ, so what's coming up next Monday?
Well, the great thing about these five dinners, and this last Monday was the first of five. Next Monday's number two with Marcy Jimenez. She's one of my favorite farmers. And again, we're going to just utilize everything that she has.
Oh, that sounds so good. And that's the 19th. And then you have them every Monday all the way through October 10th. And it's what, $55 with wine pairing?
$55 with wine pairing. And usually the way we do it, I'll make the menu and then Lou pairs wine from what we have in stock. So.
Oh, man, that sounds great. And tell us again where Lou is. It's in a really interesting spot.
Lou's on Vine Street, just north of Melrose, in a little strip mall next to a laundromat. The address is 724 North Vine Street.
All right, DJ. Well, thank you so much. This is very inspiring, and I love talking to you. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
That was DJ Olson, and he's this amazingly creative chef from Lou. And he's celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Farmer's Market by having, he has these all the time, but these are extra special themed dinners for us for the 30th anniversary. Alex Weiser is going to be at the Good Food Festival Street Food Fair this weekend at Santa Monica High School. Alex, of course, is the potato and melon guy from the Santa Monica markets. Alex, you have these wonderful padrone peppers. They taste great when they're roasted, and you are going to actually be tabletop roasting your padrones this weekend at the high school. Tell us what that's going to look like.
Well, I just got a new roaster. A chili roaster that I got from New Mexico. It's a little scaled-down version of the bigger ones that you see. And I'm going to roast these padrones. We'll play a little Spanish roulette because these padrone peppers, 1 in 10 are hot. And they're very popular in Spain. I was there a couple years ago and fell in love with these peppers. And now I've been growing them ever since.
They're very wrinkly.
They're very wrinkly.
And they're kind of long.
Like habanero, a little long. They could get big if you let them stay on the plant.
Okay.
But the thing that we try to do is to pick them every day or every other day to keep them small. Because once the plant starts producing larger peppers, then the whole variety starts getting hot.
Okay.
So we're trying to keep them mild, though that 1 in 10 will be very hot.
So people knew, I mean, they're so little, they're so great. You can toss them in a hot skillet and then just cook them whole.
Oh,
and then you eat them with eggs or you just eat them with salt and beer.
There's so many ways you can prepare them. A lot of chefs have been buying them and using them in several different ways. But I like it just simply blistering them with a nice salt, and that's it, and a nice cold beer, and that's what they do in Spain, and I kind of like it. It's a summer treat every year.
That was Alex Weiser. He has got a little tabletop pepper roaster. He's going to be roasting these wonderful padrone peppers, and he'll be at the Santa Monica High School for the 30th anniversary Good Food Festival Street Fair, 10 till 7 on Saturday, 10 till 5 on Sunday, and come on down and get a pepper and bring your own salt. Campus, you can't have a beer there, but you can sure take them home and enjoy a beer once you get home. So this Saturday at the high school, we're going to have activities, gardening, canning, preserving. We're going to have chef demos both days, Saturday and Sunday. So we hope to see you there at the high school Saturday and Sunday. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe from DJ Olson is on the Good Food blog. Tomorrow, September 18th, marks the finale of a summer devoted to pie. 3 months and 77 pies after the start of our 2011 Pie a Day project, we are finally celebrating my favorite dessert at the 3rd annual Good Food Pie Contest this Sunday at LACMA. Join me on Sunday to cheer on the contestants and taste over 200 homemade pies. Model your favorite apron in the Apron Fashion Show and enjoy family day activities provided by LACMA. KCRW DJ Ann Litt will provide the soundtrack. Festivities begin at 2 p.m. I'll see you there. This morning on Good Food, I have with me two of my favorite guests, Evan George and Alex Brown, also known as the Hot Knives. Their recently published cookbook, Salad Daze, spelled D-A-Z-E, is an adventure in pantry raiding. They're here to tell us how to get corn syrup out of our pantries by making our own homemade condiments. So take us through sort of condiment making 101. What should be our, which recipe should be our starting point?
Well, one of the first that we experimented with is a homemade sriracha. We call it cock sauce because of the rooster. And the first time we made it, it turned out bright orange. It was sort of a meh experience. It was a little too hot because we used Thai chilies. A whole sort of discovery process happened. We did what we usually do, which is read a bunch of random blogs on the subject, kind of find our own way. We ended up doing Fresno chilies, which are mild enough that you can actually gobble it up like you would sriracha. We've started aging it for a couple days out on the counter with the garlic, and it gets a little bubbly and effervescent and funky, and then processing it with some vinegar, some sugar. You get the corn syrup out. You don't use stabilizers, so it's close. It's not, you know, it's an approximation, and it's one that we really dig and is easy to do with your own produce.
And, of course, the idea of doing fermented chili sauces goes back to
the granddaddy of them all, in America anyway, Tabasco.
Exactly, yes. My eighth grade history teacher, Giles Pennington, had dinner with the man who created Tabasco once. And
McElhenney.
Yeah. He leaned over to him. My teacher was a young boy at the time. And he said, "You know what, kid? The bottle is worth more than the juice." So that's another thing to think about with condiments. I mean, the money that you're spending, I mean, what are you spending it on? Labeling, packaging, and a whole bunch of garbage, and then maybe a little bit of vegetables.
Okay, so we have our homemade rooster sauce. What else do we need?
A lot of the other ideas for making condiments were also born out of our frustration for cost and cost prohibitiveness. There's this really famous curry spice called a curry blend called Vadivan. The best part about it is it's sort of suffusing the two pillars of really, really great culinary like hegemons, right? You've got all the spices of India and then you've got onions and butter from France. And our process is pretty simple. It's really time consuming, but the bulk of the mix, which ends up sort of having this texture of like beef jerky, is just really thinly sliced onions that have been fried lightly in butter, a lot of spices also fried lightly in butter, and then the whole amalgam mushed together, laid out on a sheet pan and dried overnight at 200 degrees.
So it's almost like a little spice ball, like a slightly moist spice ball that you could throw into anything.
Exactly. And we have a recipe for glazed carrots where it's just thrown in with the butter or oil to give it kind of a curry kick.
Yeah.
And it just dissolves in whatever fat you're cooking with. And it's awesome.
Okay, so we have our hot sauce.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have our curry spice.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you have something a little more herbal for me?
So a lot of our friends, I'm sure, buy olive oil at Trader Joe's. We don't. It's not the greatest olive oil. Say you have to because it's in your budget or whatever, or even cheaper olive oil. We found that one way to get a really striking olive oil flavor almost straight from the tree is to take some decent, maybe dry cured black olives, puree them, steep your crummy olive oil in them, strain it out. It tastes like a $30 olive oil.
That's kind of genius. When you go about making your own condiment, are you trying to slavishly reproduce the same flavor profile as the store-bought condiment that you're familiar with? Or do you sort of look for an opportunity to refine it to your palate?
We've taken both approaches, and I think there's merit to both. Most recently, playing around with a hoisin sauce, I found that I didn't really want it to taste like the hoisin you get for your pho or something because it's so sugary and so molassesy. And we were playing with fresh plums, so it's almost more of a plum sauce. And it comes out really tart, but perfect for something like a banh mi sandwich.
I think the road to figuring out the specificity in your condiments is sort of oscillating between the two. Like, have your jar of mustard next to you when you're trying to make mustard so you know what it's supposed to taste like and what you like, and then sort of shape it from there.
Yeah, once I start going down the vinegar-sweet balance, for me, that is just a road that is completely fraught.
Mm-hmm. It's dangerous.
Well, if most people saw how much sugar or corn syrup they had to add to make it taste like
it's
what they're
shocking,
used to,
isn't it?
You really wouldn't want it anymore if you made it yourself.
Yeah. It'd be like making your own Coca-Cola. Like putting that much sugar into a thing that you're about to put in your body is a little
it's
terrifying.
Hard to do. It's easy to do if you're just going to feed it to somebody else and kind of chuckle.
So thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Always a pleasure.
That was Evan George and Alex Brown, authors of Salad Days. We'll have a link to the book and a recipe for their homemade rooster sauce, what they call cock sauce, on our website. I admit it, I'm a condiment abuser. I've been known to dump sriracha on everything, rice bowls, hamburgers, even shellfish. Independent producer Christopher Johnson, he grew up in around Washington, D.C., where crabs are seasoned with one thing only, Old Bay. This time of year in Washington, D.C. marks the end of the Maryland crab season. He recently stopped by two places that offer some of the city's best.
Hey now, we got that fresh! Hey now, we got that fresh over here!
Ask my family in Washington where to get the best D.C. crabs, cooked or still crawling, and the answer will be unanimous. Get down to the D.C. Wharf. Just over a mile south of the White House, the Wharf Market is basically several big stalls set up in a squared-off horseshoe. Dozens of fishmongers hawk 15-pound mackerels, plus sharp fin red snappers with bellies shining like pink lemonade against the packing ice.
Hey, lady, come on down, lady.
But most of the folks here this morning are lined up at Captain White's Seafood City for the Maryland Blue Crabs. Billy White owns the place. He's watching a delivery crew unload thousands of live crabs, all for his customers who just can't get enough.
I'm addicted, too. I have to eat crabs like twice a week. Chesapeake Bay furnishes the best crabs in the world.
Here we go. One, two.
A stall worker dumps a bushel basket full of lentil green crabs out onto the ice display. Most of the blue on these blue crabs is on their legs and on their claws. Some of the bold ones immediately make a run for it, skittering off the edge and plunking down into the Potomac River. The others get coated in Old Bay seasoning and cooked to order. Claudette has just picked up 24, the steam piping out of her bag of crabs can't stop her twin girls from digging in before they're out of the parking lot.
They love these crabs. We come down here every weekend and get these crabs. We just eat them. We eat crabs all the time.
The Old Bay, the lump back fin meat, breaking into a crab cracks open some beautiful memories for lots of Washington natives.
I grew up eating them. Yes, I did. Okay. Sitting down with my family, sitting at the table eating crabs. That's my favorite memory. And now I'm going to show my kids to do the same thing.
Cracking crabs is tradition in the D.C. area. My mom taught me how to eat blue crabs probably before I'd cleared third grade. Every summer holiday that we could afford it, we'd spread newspaper out on the floor or the patio and get to cracking. Crabs weren't just about the food, they were about time. When someone said, let's get some crabs, what they meant was, let's splurge on some good food, sit down for a while, and spend some time together. If that style is a little too do-it-yourself, folks at the Dancing Crab Restaurant in Tinleytown are happy to walk any novice through their first plate of bay crabs.
It's very labor-intensive. You do need to know what you're doing when you open them.
Will you show me later how to open a crab?
I'll mess up my manicure, but sure. I can do it in my sleep.
Manager Christina Leach has worked here for almost 4 decades. Over the years, she's picked up tips from Eastern Shore mariners who have passed through, along with D.C. mayors, Redskins, and movie stars.
There's a way to pry off what some people call the key.
To get her system, you gotta flip the crab on its back and then take the whole thing in from a Washingtonian's eye view.
On the male, it looks like the Washington Monument. On the female, it looks like the Capitol Dome.
The trick works on any blue crab, no matter how big. The Dancing Crab sells mostly males. Maryland has some strict rules that give crabbers only about a week to catch females. That allows the blue crabs to repopulate. Back in the Dancing Crab's tight but tidy kitchen, the cooks sort the crabs into 6 sizes. From small, about 5 inches, to 9-inch monsters. They're also looking for ones that are moving slowly, or not at all, because the grim business of crab cooking means they must be steamed alive.
The old-fashioned way to steam crabs, you take a big pot and you put bricks in the bottom, you put water, and then you put in a layer of crabs, sprinkle some spice, and then more crabs and more spice, and then cook them for 30 minutes.
Here they use a pressure system that cooks everything in half that time. The crabs get tossed into steamers about the size of metal trash cans. Next, a few scoops of J.O. spice, which comes from Baltimore. It tastes kind of like Old Bay, but has a lot more heat. Then slap on the lid, add some. And 20 minutes later, there's a tray in front of Christina and I, piled high with flaming red crabs. Now, this is some messy work, so don't wear your church clothes to crack crabs. If you're still nervous about a mess, opt for the plastic bib. Other tools of the trade, a wooden mallet, a short knife, and a pint of crisp summer lager.
Now I'm going to show you how to eat one. Start by taking the big claws off. Ooh, some meat pulled out there.
Fat hangs off the sides of the crabs like fried egg. Although she claims it's a sign of freshness, Christina says folks from around here usually don't touch it. Instead, with a deftness that's almost surgical, she zeroes in on the big claws.
What we do to get into the claws is we position the knife just above the pinchers here, and we lightly tap it just to go through the top shell, kind of flick it, and then we wiggle and pull the whole claw meat out. Yummy. Now, to get into the body part, we turn the crab over on its back, and we'll start at the top of the Washington Monument. We'll peel that part back. There we go.
Christina snaps the crab's big shell off like she's popping the hood on a Chevy convertible. And now we're in.
Anything that's inside the inner cavity here, we scrape into the shell. Some people like to eat this.
When I was little, all that yellow goop inside, my mom euphemistically called it mustard. Sometimes Japanese visitors ask the staff for spoons to scoop out this delicacy they call kani miso. It's the intestines, the stomach, viscera, and other stuff. We're not as enthusiastic.
Once we've got the crab cleaned up, we're going to take the knife back by the back fin, and we're just going to make the little incision there. Then I grab the knuckle, squeeze, and pull, and there we go. Here is your lollipop.
A lollipop. She's pried a leg so cleanly from the body that it comes out with this thick, Tootsie Pop-sized chunk of marble white crab meat stuck to the end.
It is so tender and sweet and just kind of melts in your mouth.
The Chesapeake Bay blue crab is Maryland state food and about as close as D.C. gets to a city dish. What's that say about Washingtonians? Christina's theory is that D.C. people, like the best crab crackers, are detail-oriented. It's also about durability. These crabs are hardy, just like this town's affinity for steamed blue crabs. After all, this food takes a lot of work. Even the dead ones don't go quietly. Cracking spicy shells for hours can shred your fingertips. Some cities would just give up and look for culinary pride in sandwiches or soups. But not D.C. These are Southern people who believe in taking their time to socialize. Visiting, they call it. And crabs are social food. It's about how you eat as much as what you eat. And to get the most out of both, you have to go slowly. For Good Food, I'm Christopher Johnson.
That was Christopher Johnson, a native of Washington, D.C., and a crab aficionado. Christopher's story comes to us through KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Stay tuned. I've got some more deep-sea delicacies coming up after this short break.
Jump into a new mode of music discovery with the KCRW Music Mine. It's our first iPad app dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine brings you an interactive experience with a constantly evolving galaxy of audio, video, and photos. Discover by artist, by DJ, or by song, and easily share the music you love with friends. The KCRW Music Mine. Dig into it on your iPad. More info at kcrw.com.
This is Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. With so much conflicting information about the sustainability of our oceans, it's no wonder that many of us are still confused when it comes to eating fish. Is it wild? Is it farmed? How was it caught? When was it caught? Is one better than the other? The questions are endless, and no single fish brings up more questions than bluefin tuna. So when I learned about a bluefin tuna ranching operation just south of the border in Mexico, I was intrigued to learn more. Rex Ito, president of Primetime Seafood, is here to tell us about it. I asked him to explain the difference between farm fish and ranched fish.
Yeah, well, farm fish is considered any fish that's grown from spawn broodstock, from egg to harvest. And a ranch fish is a fish that is caught in the wild, then fed and fattened and grown to be harvested 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years later.
So much of what goes on with fish is very mysterious to most of us who aren't fishermen, because it happens in the water and we can't see it like we can see livestock on land. So describe what a ranch looks like for fish. How big is it? How do you create a quote pen?
Tuna pens, if you've ever seen them, are floating rings of like giant plastic pipe that are 40 in the case of tuna are between 45 and 50 meters in diameter and about 15 meters deep, and those pens are anchored with heavy ropes and anchors so that they'll move with the current. They'll go up and down with the waves, but they won't move as far as the change of sight.
And how many tuna ranches are there around the world now, and where are they?
Well, bluefin tuna is really the only tuna that's ranched throughout the world. And there's ranches basically in four parts of the world. It started in Australia, and it's now in the Mediterranean, Baja California, and in Japan.
what are the benefits of bringing the tuna out of the wild, this enormous fish, and putting it in a pen?
Obviously, you have access to that fishery year-round, as opposed to being accessible only in, through the seasons. As far as the handling of the fish, the feeding of the fish, you can basically program the quality of the meat by feeding a better diet, giving it better, in the case of bluefin tuna, a higher fat content. And also the handling of the fish, once when that fish is harvested, is basically something you can control and you can time with the market. We're now catching and growing this fish in a sustainable manner. Basically, bluefin tuna can double its weight every year in a pen. So if you catch 100 pounds of tuna live in 3 years, that would be 800 pounds.
So how many pounds of wild fish does it take to create 1 pound of muscle mass in the bluefin tuna ranched versus in the wild?
In the wild, it's estimated that it takes 15 to 25 pounds of small pilchards or whatever the diet is in the wild for 1 pound of fish mass. In the pens, we're approaching between 13 and 17, so an average of 15 pounds of fresh or freshly defrosted fish to make 1 pound of tuna.
So when you ranch, you have to find the wild fish and then bring them to the pen.
Correct.
How do you go about doing that?
So it works like this, or it started, I'd say the history is like this. In the past, most tuna were caught for the canned tuna business. And so these purse seiners will go out to fish tuna and catch a whole school of tuna, braille them on board, freeze them up, and take them to the cannery for, you know, very, very low prices, maybe less than 50 cents a pound. What happened in the bluefin business is that the technology is such that the bluefin purse seiners can go out, wrap a school of bluefin, and instead of brailing it up on board, there's towing vessels with pens that shadow the purse seiner. And when the purse seiner makes a set, or basically wraps a school, they'll call the towing vessel in and then herd the tuna in, like cattle style, into the floating cage. And then that pen is then towed at 1 to 2 knots to your culture site where it's anchored, and then the fish are then stable and fed and harvested as per market.
Could you just describe a purse seiner?
A purse seiner is a large vessel. It has a capacity to hold a gigantic net. We'll drop a net, I'm not sure, maybe 500 feet deep. It's basically setting down a curtain into the water.
Once you have the fish at the culture site and they're there for the length of time they're there, do they spawn while they're there?
They can. It's been documented now for the last 3 years that there's been the larger brood stock size animals have spawned in the pens, and we've been releasing millions and millions of eggs into the sea. There's also a technology of capturing those eggs and putting them through a hatchery and raising them to fingerlings, which is done successfully but not commercially in Japan currently.
One thing I wonder about is bluefin tuna is this very large warm-blooded animal, and it swims very fast, 40 miles an hour. If you have a fish of that size penned, even in a large pen, does the texture of its musculature change?
That's a great question, and it's it does slightly, I would say. It's very hard to tell, to be honest with you. As far as the wild fish, as far as quality of the wild fish compared to a penned bluefin, the top connoisseurs of bluefin will recognize that the best bluefin flavor would be from a wild-caught fatty bluefin caught from cold waters at a certain time of year and with a certain kind of diet. That being said, that's probably less than 10% of the bluefin caught in the world because the conditions just don't always give you that top quality meat. It's like catching an animal in its perfect state at the perfect time of the year.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Rex Ito, president of Primetime Seafood. Rex was describing the process known as bluefin tuna ranching. What are your rules when it comes to eating fish? I'd love to know. Join the conversation on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. For me, when it comes to fish, there's no one I trust more than Paul Greenberg. He's the author of the book For Fish, and he's a frequent contributor to the New York Times. Paul recently visited Alaska's Bristol Bay, where the sockeye salmon population is fighting an uphill battle against the copper mining industry.
Bristol Bay is the heartland. It's the last stand of wild salmon in this country and perhaps in the world. You know, it's where pretty much all of our canned salmon comes from. It's where a lot of fresh frozen salmon comes from. It's the workhorse of wild salmon. Right now, though, a consortium of two companies called Anglo-American and Northern Dynasty have bonded together into this thing called the Pebble Partnership. And they are trying to put the continent's largest copper mine right at the headwaters of the largest sockeye salmon left on Earth up in Bristol Bay. And if you look at the plan of it, I mean, it's vast and, in my opinion, very much does pose a very credible threat. We're talking about a mine that will produce 10 billion tons of slag and create a lake behind where all the mining is happening. That will be 2,000 feet deep. And we'll have a great deal of sulfur dioxide contained in the water that poses a huge risk. I should also add that it's an earthquake area or an earthquake zone. There's a fault line at least 20 miles nearby, possibly a fault running through the strike itself. So if we do get a major earthquake in that area, you could have a major impact on the salmon run.
Those lakes that would be created would be the result of dams that they have to put up, correct?
Yeah, I actually was in July. I flew over the site with actually a Republican former legislator from Alaska named Rick Halford, and he was, you know, pointing out to me just the vastness of this scale. And he said, "Okay, well, you know, judging by what our engineers have said, the amount of slag would be so big that in order to contain it, you would have to." And he pointed off to a mountain. He said, "Probably they'll have to attach an anchor for one dam over here," and he points to another mountain, and that's where the other anchor will be. And he points way down to the other side of the valley. It's like, well, and that's pretty much where they're going to have to put the other dam. So you're really talking about kind of walling in this you know, pristine area. And it's, you know, the reason I should say that there is so much waste from this mine, it's a very diffuse deposit of copper. In fact, if you were to look at it by concentration, there's more sulfur in this mine than there is copper. So they have to sift through, you know, as I said, 10 billion tons of rock to get, you know, their tiny little bit of copper that's from here. I mean, it's tiny on a per pound basis. The strike is huge. It's valued at potentially more than $300 billion. And there's also a sizable gold deposit there as well. So we're talking about a lot of money, but we're also talking about, you know, a very, very big operation in order to get to all that money.
I understand that salmon are extremely sensitive to copper.
They are. Yeah, so over and above the sulfur issue where, you know, sulfur is obviously a huge problem, copper has been shown in somewhere on the order of 3 parts per billion is enough to throw off a salmon's sense of smell. And you could say, well, who cares? A bunch of salmon can't smell too well. But actually, salmon use their sense of smell for migration purposes. So if you did get a failure and did have a release of copper into the water, you could basically throw off the navigation of a run of 40 million salmon every year. And they'd swim hundreds, if not thousands, of miles in their migration routes. So if they don't have the ability to migrate, that's a really serious problem.
Is there a sense, percentage-wise, of how you feel if it's going to go ahead or if the EPA intervention will succeed?
Well, first of all, right now it's an EPA evaluation. They're looking at it and trying to decide whether this merits a Clean Water Act action. I think if you were just to look at it objectively as a scientist, it would be pretty obvious and you would rule, you know, sure, you would rule, no, this can't possibly go ahead. This will hurt the fishery. But it's a sensitive time. You know, next year is we're into election season. This could become this real, you know, focal point issue. Like, is the EPA the ultimate, you know, democratic evil that is, you know, keeping Americans from getting at valuable resources and creating jobs? Or is the EPA, you know, a guardian of a sacred trust and, you know, a body of able scientists who can accurately and soundly judge whether a salmon resource is more valuable than a mining resource?
So let's talk about the salmon resource. Let's say the salmon go away because of this mine. So then we start looking at GMOs. So let's talk for a minute now about genetically modified salmon. If the wild sockeye salmon population were to be depleted, could it be replaced with GMO salmon in our grocery stores?
So humans have had a tendency to eradicate wild fish and replace them with farmed ones. And that's happened with Atlantic salmon, where we used to have very viable runs of Atlantic salmon from Connecticut up to Maine and in the European part of their range as well. Those fish are mostly gone and have been entirely replaced by farmed fish. As farmed fish, or as the fish farming industry has progressed and gotten more efficient and so forth, the next sort of phase in this is people are trying to do a genetically modified salmon. So now there's a company called Aqua Bounty, which has put a fish that they've run through development, and it's called the AQ Advantage salmon. And what this is, it's an Atlantic salmon DNA with a Chinook salmon growth gene inserted into it, and then a regulator protein from a third fish called an ocean pout, which, by the way, is not kosher, which put permanently in the on position. And that makes this genetically modified salmon grow twice as fast as the typical farmed salmon. So I think, you know, if you were to run the numbers and you said, well, okay, let's turn all of North American salmon, farmed salmon, into genetically modified salmon, we could potentially gain about 200 million more pounds of salmon a year. Interestingly enough, if we were to lose Bristol Bay, we would lose about 200 million pounds of salmon.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Paul Greenberg. He's the author of Four Fish. If you haven't read it, read it. We'll have a link to the book as well as information about Bristol Bay on our website. Coming up, it's Gabba Gabba Hey. Find out what it is in 1 minute here on KCRW 89.9 and KCRW.com.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food. I'm here with Stephen Gadula, and we're about to talk about a strange new confection called, say it for me, Stephen.
Gob.
It's a gob.
G-O-B. It is a gob.
What is a gob?
A gob is best described as a small cake. There are two very moist domes with some really delectable frosting in the middle. It is in many ways, I've compared it to a cupcake sandwich. When push has come to shove, I've had to compare them to whoopie pies, another Northeast confection. But in shape and in size, that's where the similarity ends.
So where did they originate?
The word gob as a confection goes all the way back. I believe you can find it in 16th century German, but in southwestern Pennsylvania, it became a treat coming out of Johnstown, Pennsylvania. There were some ties to the Pennsylvania Dutch community in middle Pennsylvania and in eastern Pennsylvania. But from what I've been able to gather, it seems that it resulted from leftover cake batter, that just dollops of cake batter were put on a pan, frosted, and given to kids. And this seems to be where this came from. But when I was growing up, I knew none of that. I just knew that these were something that were on every cookie tray or dessert tray. And it wasn't until I actually went away to college at Penn State, when I was meeting people from other parts of the country, that I realized this is not a confection that is known elsewhere.
Now, whoopie pies have marshmallow filling. Describe, if you can, what the filling is in a gob.
Sure. Well, for my recipes, I rely on a cream cheese frosting with butter. My frosting is flavored with syrups that I make. For instance, if I'm making a pumpkin gob, I will save the liquid that I extract from the pumpkin pulp that has been seasoned with clove or cinnamon, and I'll add some sugar, some citrus juice as well. I will then take that syrup and whip it into the frosting. Traditionally, in a gob, especially as my parents made them, because, of course, they were coming from a post-war time kitchen, they relied on Crisco. My personal preference is for a butter and cream cheese frosting.
And what did you name it?
Well, I took the name from the Ramones refrain, Gabba Gabba Hey, which actually goes back to a Todd Browning film. But I thought that because my confection was called a gob, that I could tweak the Gabba Gabba Hey and call it Gabba Gabba Hey, and that people would know when they heard, oh, Gabba Gabba Hey gobs, that people would understand what I was selling, which turned out not to be the case at all. So there was a little bit of a learning curve involved with my customers, but they were overall very excited and very receptive. And it still astounds me that they were welcoming and then they would eat it and they would put this in their mouths, even though they had no idea who I was, where I came from, what it was that I was offering them.
So what are the flavors that people are intrigued by and buying now?
People seem to, first of all, chocolate and vanilla will never go out of style. That's always a favorite. I get an awful lot of requests here in the Bay Area for the matcha green tea with the lemongrass ginger syrup. That is very popular. There's some seasonal favorites. I would say the pumpkin spice, people start asking for that as soon as the weather just has even just a hint of a chill in the air. So that one's very popular in the fall. I know that the orange cardamom ginger with saffron has always been a favorite. The strawberry with basil is another big seller. So it's interesting. I've noticed that different offices, for instance, that order from me have their favorites, and I have families that have their favorites. So, but I would say that those are the ones that people request over and over again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan. It was wonderful. Thanks.
That was Stephen Gadula. His cookbook is Gabba Gabba Hey. A link to his website, along with where to order Stephen's gobs, are on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Time now for a visit from Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me here every week with a restaurant recommendation. This week, we're going back in time to visit Chef John Sedler's first restaurant, Santa Steph.
John Sedler, as you know, you and I have talked about a million times, is probably one of the most important and influential chefs in Los Angeles history in a way that a lot of people going to places like Rivera and Playa now just probably don't even know about.
So let's talk about some of the emblematic things that John created that you see in other places. But I would say that no one does it even today as well as he does it.
First, you got to talk a little bit about his background, right? I mean, he worked at L'Hermitage with Jean Bertrand, which was like the important French restaurant of the evolution of L.A. cooking. When he left to start his own restaurant, Santa Steph, in Manhattan Beach in a mall that I think had a Chili's and Olive Garden, you know, and a Coco's in it. It's like one of those malls.
And this is the day, I mean, nobody had a restaurant in a mall then of that significance.
No, I mean, it's interesting. L.A. is now known as the city where you eat in mini malls, but it didn't happen back then. And it started as a really sort of orthodox French restaurant. I was just looking at a menu from 1983, and it was just – it surprised me. It surprised the hell out of me. And he started introducing a lot of different chilies to his food. The presentation started to be weird and colorful and abstract, and – it was really the first spasm of, I guess, what you'd call new Southwest cuisine, which everybody assumes sprung up in Santa Fe or with, you know, Piles in Dallas, but in fact came out of a mini mall in Manhattan Beach.
And so much of what was sort of classic cultural artifacts from the art world ended up on his plate. So you have these stencils. And you have painting. So he was like a chef muralist.
I remember when I think reviewed his restaurant, Saint Estef, in 1986, showing my age a little bit, that I had a lot to say about this appetizer, which when you looked at it was a plate of nothing. Right? There was like a star like squiggled out in like a chili cream sauce squeezed out of a squirt bottle. There were like three corn kernels somewhere, and there was a blue corn tortilla chip in the shape of a star.
Or a cactus.
Yeah. and you finally figured out you were supposed to like break it off and scrape it through the sauce, and it was actually pretty good. Looking back on that plate, that was the first blue corn tortilla chip. I mean, that was something that we totally take for granted that we could buy by the bushel at Trader Joe's. It had to start somewhere, and it started there.
So now let's come to present day, in which this idea of a pop-up generally means a chef who maybe doesn't have a restaurant showing up at some strange place, like with Ludo. Ludo inhabits a space at night and creates everything.
Yeah, this is actually a new idea of a pop-up. It's a chef doing a pop-up within his own restaurant.
Of himself.
Exactly.
It's so great.
So, you know, it's kind of like going to a Neil Young show, and then suddenly there's a set by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young somewhere in there. And it felt exactly like 1986. I mean, there was that, you know, sometimes you see something or you hear a song on the radio, and it brings you exactly to a time and a place. And I've got to say, tasting this food and these combinations that I probably hadn't had since the 80s was remarkable in that way. For example, there was a chili relleno. It was just one roasted chili, and it was stuffed with d'oseille, which is, you know, the classic French garnish.
Mushroom preparation.
Of like mushrooms that are chopped really fine, maybe with onions, maybe not, and then sauteed in butter and cooked down until it becomes like this wonderful, total savory mushroom essence. And it was stuffed with those. So you're having, you know, first you're having chili rellenos, which are, or the roasted chili, which is totally Southwest. And then you're having something that couldn't be more French inside of it. And it was on this little, like, pillow of, like, a goat cheese cream sauce. And it came together in a way, and you realized, as in so few instances in, you know, the world of cuisine, that you were actually tasting something new, something that had not been done before.
So what were some of the highlights for you of the menu, of the Saint Estef menu?
I think I may have ordered basically the same things I ordered, you know, the last time I went. They had, you know, ravioli stuffed with carne arrovata, which is something that's so common now that we don't even think about it anymore, right? I mean, I think it's on the menu at the Cheesecake Factory. Or maybe the Cheesecake Factory actually took it off the menu in 2002. It's so old. There was the painted desert salmon, which I remember like adoring the first time around, and there it was, almost exactly the same. A little piece of steamed salmon, not as rare as probably to be served now, on this plate that had been squiggled with three different sauces. It kind of looks like an EKG chart in, you know, as realized in sauce.
Let's concentrate on a couple more dishes so people get an idea of what they can expect if they get to go.
There were the what is delightfully described on the menu as Coquille Saint-Jacques Nacho. Which is to say, big, beautiful scallops that are like seared on one side, almost very rare, served with a cheese sauce and gorditas.
And the desserts were gorgeous.
If only he still served that chocolate chili relleno.
Oh, man. With those little blue corn candies.
Yeah. God, it's like two people sitting around and remembering how good Duran Duran used to be, isn't it?
Thank you so much, Jonathan, for coming in to do this. I really wanted to be able to share this sort of evanescent experience with our listeners so people could get the opportunity to go and have this time travel.
Thanks. It was really fun.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold of the LA Weekly about Santa Steph, a pop-up restaurant inside John Sedler's Rivera that recreates the 1986 menu from the now bygone restaurant. I went to one of the dinners, and I have to tell you, it's extraordinary. Go if you get a chance. The special menu will be featured until the end of September. You can get the exact address sent to your cell phone in a text message. All you have to do is text the words "good food" to the number 69866. That's "good food" to the number 69866. And see all of Jonathan Gold's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant Map, which, of course, is on the Good Food blog. I'll be back after this short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to KCRW 89.9 and KCRW.com.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Before you even walk into a new restaurant, architects and designers have spent months, maybe even years, poring over choices that will showcase the owner's idea of what the dining experience should be. Architecture and design are often the hidden keys to a good dining experience. I'm here this morning with Steve Jones. He's the principal and lead designer at SF Jones Architects in Manhattan Beach. In addition to high-rise buildings, hurricane-damaged homes, and mixed-use housing projects, the company's been a major player in restaurant innovation in Southern California and across the country. So great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So what is your philosophy regarding the visual experience of a restaurant?
Well, I think it's important to have an experience where you have the immediate impact when you come in. Your first impression has a nice wow feeling, kind of sets the tone for your experience for the rest of the your dining.
So much of building a restaurant is about infrastructure, the things that support the whole kitchen side, and also all of the mechanical, the plumbing and the ducting for the air conditioning and all of that. And that's really expensive, the things that a diner never even thinks about.
Right.
So by the time you get to that overlay that the diners actually interact with finishes, oftentimes the budget has to get a little squeezed. Is that one reason why restaurants are so loud? Everybody is asking me this question.
You know what? It doesn't have to be that way. I mean, if the thing is when you design, you think your priorities first. You put whatever priority is up front so that you design around them. And sound, it seems to be one of the elements that's not really thought of at the beginning of a project, and it becomes the result of everything else except for sound. And, a lot of times you'll get a beautiful view, that you can't ignore, and, there's glass has hard surfaces that are going to cause you acoustic problems. But then you have to think about how you're going to isolate that. How are you going to, you think about the source of where the sound is coming from. And the recent project we just finished, I had I was thinking about that because that was a concern. This is for the Manhattan Beach Post, which was like a post office. We designed an element that kind of looked like old post office boxes. And in between it, we sandwiched in acoustic panels that nobody really knows are even there. And that really was able to keep the sound down to a minimum.
How much does it cost these days to build out a restaurant per foot?
It's probably around $250 a square feet. You know, when you talk about cost, you know, there are construction costs, there's construction and equipment, there's personnel, there's training. So, you know, it's hard to put together a whole number that people can relate to because there's so many variables that go into it. The trend now, I think, is more to get spaces that are already restaurants, because that's really the cheapest way to go, that already have entitlements as far as the square footage of the space and parking and equipment, infrastructure, you know, somewhat in the space it's going to go.
The grease trap.
The grease trap. It's always one of the big surprises for new restaurateurs. I got to do what? But it's those things that can help keep costs down, especially when like a first-time restaurateur who's going into a space. If they're going into a space that was originally retail and they think that they're going to be able to do it for cheap, you know, they're probably going to be surprised.
It seems like now more than ever, the trend seems to be very eclectic. You see all different kinds of styles popping up kind of simultaneously. Is there currently sort of a design template that seems to be working more than any other?
Well, obviously the reclaimed wood, green products, you know, that's the flavor of the day, I would say.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you.
That was Steve Jones. He's the principal and lead designer at SF Jones Architects in Marina Del Rey. Steve's most recent restaurant project is the recently opened MB Post in Manhattan Beach. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also find good food on demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. See you at the Good Food Pie Contest tomorrow, Sunday, at 2 p.m. at LACMA. We need help eating all of those pies. Good Food's produced by Jillian Ferguson. Lara Garcia and Candace Moyer are our segment producers. The executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Masiha, Becky Nelson, and Becky Gebhardt. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.